is not a civil war in Syria. That's probably the first thing we heard, and we heard it over and over again. It is not President Assad against his own people. It is President Assad and the Syrian people all together in unity against outside forces, outside mercenary forces, terror organizations, the names change every day or every other day to try to protect their identity and maybe keep the connection between the country that funded it and that group kind of a little bit more nebulous. But there are groups, mercenary forces, supported by Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the United States, and underneath it, Israel, the state of Israel. And these outside mercenary forces are the ones that are terrorizing the Syrian people and are attempting to divide the Syrian people.
Listen to the.
Skip ad. I was trying for this one. What a good place to segue, because Russian newspapers are covered in the next little Robo DG selection. And click forward to Gladio Biop Russia, Philip Kovacevic. Yeah.
Professor Philip Kovacevic, and this is the first edition of Russian Newspaper Monitor. If you listen to the US mass media, you would not know it. But there is quite a lot of pluralism in the Russian newspaper media landscape. This means that different political views are represented on the mass media scene in Russia. As you will see in the show, there are newspapers which support Putin and the Russian government, and at the same time, there are newspapers which are critical of him and his policies from different political perspectives. From the pro-Western press on one side to the communist press on the other side. And these are not some minor publications and websites, but genuine mass-produced newspapers. And we will examine some of their stories on the show. Today, since this is the first edition, I would like to begin by giving you an overview of the Russian newspaper media scene. Basically, today I'll talk about who is who of the...
Well, sorry, Philip, I'm going to bump you way up where you're going to be talking about the roots of the, well, I'll let you do it, but...
...states that came out of the former Soviet Union is a firm ally of Russia and also Putin. So the photo that comes with this article is the shaking of hands between the Kazakhstan president Nazarbayev and Vladimir Putin. They are shaking hands and they are smiling. They are happy to be together. And Putin is quoted extensively. You'll notice that in this newspaper that Putin is quoted extensively. That typically his photograph is either on the front page or on the page number 2 in the newspaper. And here, in this article, Putin talks about Kazakhstan being an important strategic partner and ally for Russia. He talks about investments, infrastructural projects, the highway from Western China to that Nazarbayev, who is a longtime leader of Kazakhstan. He has been the leader, the president of Kazakhstan since the breakup of the Soviet Union. So we can clearly see that Kazakhstan is closely allied to Russia, and that the U.S. NATO strategy in Central Asia is not functioning the way, for instance, Zbigniew Brzezinski wanted it to function, and the way he described it in his book from the 90s, which is called The Grand Chessboard. Now I'm going to move to the Kommersant, which, as I said, is a liberal business newspaper that is critical of Putin's foreign policy occasionally. And so Kommersant is not talking about this meeting between Putin and Nazarbayev. It's instead focusing on Ukraine. And it essentially has on the front page on October the 6th, has the article entitled "Ukraine Increases Imports of Salt Before the Ban." The article is about the Ukrainian producers of salt who are increasing their supplies because the ban on imports from Russia is going to come into force on November 1st. And the article says that the imports of salt were increased by 1.5 times in the last 3 months, and that they concern not only the regular salt, but also the so-called technical salt, which is very important for the winter because it's used on the roads after heavy snowfalls. So in my opinion, this article tries to point out the plight of the Ukrainians in the economic war between Russia and Ukraine. This newspaper, the Kommersant, which means the businessman, on the front page also has the photo of Sergei Kirienko. And Kirienko is the person Putin just appointed, to the influential post in the presidential administration, which is in charge of domestic politics in Russia. It's interesting that Kirienko was previously the director of Rosatom, which is a state agency in charge of atomic energy. Let me just explain how powerful this position is. It's shown by the fact that Vyacheslav Volodin, who held this position before, was chosen to be the president of the Russian parliament, the State Duma. So somebody who was in this position before the election, Vyacheslav Volodin, now became the president of the Russian parliament. And let me just remind you that the former president of the parliament, Sergei Naryshkin, became the new head of the Russian Foreign Intelligence Agency, the SVR, the Služba Vnešnje Razvedki. He's in charge of the Russian spies in foreign lands, and I have an article on that on the Newsbud website, which is called "Why Did the Russian Spies Get a New Boss?" Where I explain who Naryshkin is and what his policies will probably be in the coming period. Rossiyskaya Gazeta, the RG, I talked about October 5th articles, and now let's talk about the October 6th articles. It's Putin is on the front page. He's giving a speech in the Russian parliament. And for instance, the Kommersant did not put Putin on the front page, but Kirienko, even though they spoke about the same issue. It's another very interesting article on the front page of the RG for October 6th. It talks about Great Britain. And let me remind you that Britain has been the longtime opponent of Russia from the time of the Russian Empire and the British Empire. In fact, the Great Game was a geopolitical struggle between Russia and Britain in Eurasia, and it continues to this day. So this article is very interesting because it's a critique of Great Britain. The title is Great Britain Wants to Return to the Age of Colonial Wars, and the subtitle is A License to Kill. And the article is about the British want to withdraw their soldiers from the jurisdiction of the European Convention for Human Rights. It's based on the report by the British newspaper Guardian about the speech by the British Prime Minister Theresa May and the Minister of Defense Michael Fallon at the Conservative Party convention that took place a couple of days ago. And essentially the purpose is not to allow the British soldiers to be sued for the crimes and abuses of power that they committed in recent wars. For instance, let me just give you one example from the article. In Iraq and Afghanistan, since 2004, the British government had to pay close to £1 million in damages. This article is based on the report in The Guardian, but it also continues. It adds, it is much more critical of the British government than The Guardian because it adds another section which is entitled Facts of History. And in this section, the journalist for the RG, for the Rasistska Gazeta, chronicles the bloody history of the British colonial interventions in South Africa, in India, and in Kenya. For instance, the article mentions that 25 million Indians died of hunger during the British rule of India because tons of wheat and other foodstuffs were exported to Europe. So what we have in the RG consistently on the front pages is a critique. First, the United States, that was 2 days ago, and yesterday was the critique of the British government and their policies. Let me just talk about a couple more articles. Let's cover the Izvestia, which, as I said, is a pro-government, moderately pro-government newspaper. It had a very interesting article in the edition for October 6, 2016. The article is entitled, A New Division of Heavy Bomber Aircraft Was Formed. And the subtitle says, These aircraft will patrol the Japan, Guam, Hawaii triangle. The article talks about the Ministry of Defense, the Russian Ministry of Defense, finishing the formation of a new aircraft division in the Russian Far East. The Russians are now putting into operations two types of strategic bombers, Tu-95MC and Tu-22M3, and they will be patrolling the waters of the Pacific. And the intention, according to this article, is to let the countries of the Pacific region and also the United States know that Russia is serious about the protection of its eastern borders and interests. And there is a photo on the front page of this newspaper of Izvestia, and the photo is of the aircraft Tu-95MC, which is a strategic bomber, the new generation strategic bomber that the Russian military industry has developed. So this article on the front page of Izvestia is telling the Russian readers and also the world at large that Russia is now going to be projecting its military power not only in Europe and Eurasia, but also in the Pacific. And specifically, it talks about this geographical triangle, Japan, Guam, and Hawaii. So let's go into the tabloid press. You know, this is interesting. So far we consider kind of the intellectual highbrow newspaper, also the government newspapers. So let's look at some tabloids. Komsomolskaya Pravda, which is a daily newspaper. Every day it publishes up to 1 million copies. It's widely read throughout Russia. And the edition for October the 4th has an article on the beginning of the fall mandatory military conscription in Russia. And there is the photo of a new recruit putting his boots on. Let me note that the draft in Russia is still in existence, as opposed to the United States. It is mandatory in Russia for all Russian men from 18 to 27 years of age. There are some exceptions, like the university students, but generally it is mandatory. It lasts for a whole year. And in fact, it was only in 2008 that the conscription was reduced from 2 years to 1 year. So essentially, Komsomolskaya Pravda is projecting this image, okay, we are getting some new soldiers in our military. And in fact, from what you have seen so far, the Russian newspapers, the government-controlled and the tabloids emphasize that the military image, the military image of Russia. In Komsomolskaya Pravda, the edition of October 5th, which is the next day, we have the announcement for the radio show of Viktor Barants. And Viktor Barants is the main military analyst for this newspaper. And the topic of this radio show is American weapons in Ukraine. So Viktor Barants, who is the main military analyst for the newspaper, is going to give a show on the American weapons in Ukraine. And there is a photo of him, and he's in uniform. He's in the uniform of a Russian military officer. And let me end the show for today by looking at Pravda. Pravda is the Communist Party newspaper. But at this point of time, the Communist Party is an opposition party in Russia. It's not in power in Russia. So in fact, it's critical. It's critical of Vladimir Putin. This is something that needs to be understood, I think, in the United States, is that there is some opposition to Putin in Russia. And it comes not only from the West, from the Western-supported media, but also from the Communist Party from the inside. So let's just look at the front page of Pravda for October 6th. What we have on the front page is first of all, the photos of a memory walk in Moscow commemorating the bloody events of October 1993, 23 years ago, when, let me remind you, there was a violent conflict between the supporters and opponents of Yeltsin, which was ended by Boris Yeltsin, who at the time was the president of Russia. He ordered the tanks to fire on the parliament building. And he was supported in this by the United States and the West. So he was, you know, he was supported to essentially destroy the parliamentary opposition by the use of force. And so the Communist Party, which supported the people who were in the parliament at the time, people who got killed, is now commemorating their sacrifice. So there are photos of the participants carrying the photos of those who were killed. This is on the front page. And also, in addition, there is a photo of the communist leader, Gennady Zhuganov, who is giving a speech. And this speech is reproduced in its entirety on the front page. And just let me briefly describe his speech, because this is very important for understanding the political scene in Russia. So Zhuganov is sharply critical, not only of Yeltsin, who's dead, and the oligarchs. He claims that these oligarchs and Yeltsin were controlled by the CIA for the destruction of the Soviet Union. He even speaks about some 60 CIA agents which controlled Russia in the early 90s. He also criticizes the current government of Russia, and by implication also Vladimir Putin, for rigging, for stealing the recent parliamentary elections. Zhuganov claims that the election results were known even before the elections were held. So he's not mentioning Putin by name, but he's criticizing the election results and also the government of Russia, which is led by Dmitry Medvedev. And Zhuganov in the end also accuses the government for the horrible management of the economy, because the GDP fell by 4% during the last year. It's interesting to note that Zhuganov's speech is full of the nostalgia for the Soviet Union and for the Soviet strong political and economic position in the world. Also on the front page of Pravda, at the same time, for the same edition, we have the photo and description of a recent social protest in Greece against the austerity measures of the Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, who ironically was elected precisely in order to eliminate those austerity measures. But unfortunately, his political radicalism and fight against the neoliberal establishment turned into a cynical betrayal of the Greek voters.
So that was a little bit, I guess, unless I am, but that mentions Zhuganov calling out the Yeltsinistas who attacked Parliament as agents of the West. Of course, that's where Putin comes from, going from his 2% popularity that he shared with a grandson, Hitler's banker, so that these two cloak and daggeristas can hold us all hostage, you know, we Stockholm Syndrome hostages, because they could have ended our lives, but you know, they didn't. And so we're grateful Russia went along because they had just done the same thing. We followed suit about false flag, state terrorism. Around nine, I'm going to read not from a newspaper, this is CRYPTOME.org, Putin bomb 5 HTML, HTM, https://, cryptome.org/Putin-bomb5.htm, and skipping down, about 9 p.m. at night on 22nd September in provincial city of Ryazan, 100 miles southeast of Moscow, Vladimir Vasiliev, V-L-A-D-I-M-I-R, V-A-S-I-L-I-E-E-V, V-A-S-I-L-I-E-V, Vasiliev, an engineer coming home for the night, noticed three strangers acting suspiciously by the basement of his block of flats at 1416 Novosyolov Street, literally New Settlers Street. Vasiliev said a white was parked outside the entrance with a boot toward the entrance. In the car were two men, young men, also young, about 20 years old. Vasiliev noticed the last two digits of the car number plate had been stuck on with paper showing 62, the Ryazan regional code. Underneath the paper was the true plate number giving a Moscow code. Vasiliev, puzzled, decided to call the police. As we were waiting for the lift and it was empty, one of the young guys got out of the car and the girl asked, "Have you done everything?" "Yes." "Okay, let's go." And they got in the car and quite quickly left. Vasiliev observed the three in the car with a mismatched plate. "I remember the driver sat at the wheel, quite thin with a mustache, and the other man was heavier. The girl had blonde hair cut short, wearing sport clothes and a leather jacket. They were Russian. Absolutely not Asiatic," unquote. The police arrived. Inspector Andrei Chernyshev, C-H-E-R-N-Y-S-H-E-V, from the local police, was the first to enter the basement. He said, "We had a signal from a man on duty. It was about 10 in the evening. There were some strangers who were seen leaving the basement from the building 1416 at Novosyolovo Street. We were met by the girl who stood by the building. She told us about the men who came out of the basement and left with a car with a license number which was covered with paper. I went down to the basement. This block of flats had a very deep basement which was completely covered with water. We could see sacks of sugar and in them some electronic device, a few wires and a clock. We were shocked. We ran out of the basement and I stayed on watch by the entrance and my officers went to evacuate the people. Grandmother Clara Stepanova recalled the night. The neighbors began to knock at the door and said, 'Get out fast, something's been planted underneath us.' We quickly grabbed what we could and leapt out. My daughter leapt out not dressed, without stockings, without tights, not anything, just flung a jacket on. The kids also dashed out not dressed. They held us away from the block of flats and started investigating. They didn't give us permission to come near." Vasiliev said, "After we were standing in the square, my wife remembered that she hadn't switched off the soap, so I went up to an MVD officer to tell him. We went up in the lift. He told me that they had really had found a device. MVD stands for Ministerio Vternyum, V-N-U-T-R-E-N-N-Y-K-H, Dell, the Interior Ministry. Yuri Chachenko, T-K-A-C-H-E-N-K-O, head of local bomb squad, went down to the basement. For me, it was a live bomb. I was in combat situation, he said. He tested the three sugar sacks in the basement with his MO2 portable gas analyzer and got a positive reading for hexogen, the explosive used in the Moscow bombs. Whoa, whoa. The timer of the detonator was set for 5:30 a.m., which would have killed many of the 250 tenants of the 13-story block of flats. The sacks were taken out of the basement around 1:30 in the morning and driven away by the FSB. But the secret police left the detonator in the hands of the bomb squad. They photographed it later that day. As the residents were finally allowed back into the homes at 7 in the morning, one of the policemen let Mrs. Stepanova see what was left. He said there was a bit left, and the policeman said, "There, that's it. That's the stuff that was meant to blow you up." The local police arrested two men that night, according to Boris Kagarlitsky, a member of the Russian Institute of Comparative Politics. FSB officers were caught red-handed while planting the bomb. They were arrested by the police, and they tried to save themselves by showing FSB identity cards. Then, headquarters of FSB in Moscow intervened. The two men were quietly let go. Ah! Oh, yeah. Gladio B. Op Russia. The newspapers, they never tell you the whole story.
What you gonna do about me?
And what are you going to do about my comment? Uprising with Snolly. Quote, in direct response to the 9/11 attacks, unquote, ... Whatever Kathy Kelly's good intentions, Wernher von Braun disciple Sonali's big lie screams full speed ahead in the other direction, fueling war by a nation of savages, blaming Afghans for our 2 drone strikes and 3 WTC demolitions after Pentagon air defense stand down? Egging on morons, murdering millions with no end in sight. So, Kathy Kelly was on the replacement for the Morning Mix that had gotten Chevron kicked out of Richmond, thanks to Alex Soto, Andrew Soto, excuse me, and all those radical programmers. But let me jump to this one, authored by Eric Zeus via Strategic Culture, Zeusse. The great investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, in 2 previous articles in the London Review of Books, Who's Sarin and The Red Line and the Rat Line, has reported that the Obama administration falsely blamed the government of Syria's Bashar al-Assad for the sarin gas attack that Obama was trying to use as an excuse to invade Syria. And Hersh pointed to a report from British intelligence saying that sarin that was used didn't come from Assad's stockpiles. Hersh also said that a secret agreement in 2012 was reached between Obama administration and leaders of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar to set up a sarin gas attack and blame it on Assad so the U.S. could invade and overthrow Assad. Oh, DJ Mouse knows about sarin. It's an organophosphate pesticide. So, when I was bidding on contracts and they were going to use these pesticides in lieu of the chainsaws and axes and stuff that our crews were using, I had to go read up on this organophosphate business. So, sarin is the same as the metacystox that they were using to kill the bugs in the forest and trees and the cone that they would pick. They'd drive this, hammer this thing in and inject it full of this organophosphate. So it says on the box the antidote is atropine, right. Nightshade, deadly nightshade, or belladonna as it's called. Now it dilates your pupils, so you will say to the pretty girl, the belladonna is interested in you, but you know, she's having a sympathetic nervous system reaction to the stimulant. The central nervous system stimulant in the sympathetic nervous system counters the stimulation of the parasympathetic nervous system by the cholinesterase inhibitor. So the organophosphate, the sarin, acts as a cholinesterase inhibitor. Of course, acetylcholine is your neurotransmitter in your vegetative system. So if you have acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, like sarin, then your acetylcholine piles up. It leaves your nervous system jammed in the on position. In the case of the vegetative jammed in the on position, that means slowing your heart rate and breathing down to zero, so it kills you. So if you kick in the other system, you know, you eat some deadly nightshade or get an injection of atropine, then that will kick on your sympathetic. And you don't keep kicking it on 13 different times. They were giving these kids 13 injections in this pretense. They staged these bogus Chemotech videos, but of course the children kidnapped in Latakia were identified by their mothers in those videos Drone Bomber was pointing to behind this story. Hersh didn't say whether these arms included precursor chemicals. Oh. By the terms of the agreement, funding came from Turkey as well as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the CIA, and support of MI6, was responsible for getting arms from Gaddafi's arsenals into Syria. Oh, yeah. So, evil's trump card, she has her greater evil foil mouth the utter truth of the special prosecutor imperative for Libya for that greatest crime, waging unprovoked war. Now, of course, the Pan Am 103 passengers, along with the South African pig Bosa, canceled at the last minute. They're friends with Israel, who had the Operation Trojan plan. to down that passenger. It's, you know, our murder puppets, of course, were behind it. Just like with the Argentine thing, they were running with that. Kirchner is covering up Iran's role and Obama's in on it. That right-wing line is papered all over. The truth is the fact there's a mushroom cloud over that explosions. It couldn't possibly be a truck bomb. It was internal demolitions. And just rubbing the world's nose in the idiocy of this moronic nation and our savagery. I believe a truck bomb leaves a mushroom cloud over the center of the building that collapses inwardly. So Hearst didn't say whether these arms included precursor chemicals for making sarin, which were stockpiled in Libya, but there have been multiple independent reports that Libya's Gaddafi possessed such stockpiles, and also that the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, was operating a rat line for Gaddafi's captured weapons into Syria through Turkey. Of course, they are willing to scream about Benghazi, Benghazi, and blame Hillary, Hillary, because it's a diversion that she's carrying on the Republican plan, the Negroponte's Salvador option, the redirection, arming first the Sunni Shia death squads, and then the Sunni reactionary. Evidence leads to rat line for Gaddafi's room. So Hirsch isn't the only reporter who's been covering this. Indeed, the investigative journalist Christoph Lehman, headline 7th October 2013, top U.S. and Saudi officials responsible for chemical weapons in Syria, and reported on the basis of very different sources than Hearst used that evidence leads directly to the White House, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, CIA Director John Brennan, Saudi Intelligence Chief Prince Bandar, and Saudi Arabia's Interior Ministry. And as if that wasn't enough, even the definitive analysis of the evidence that was performed by two leading U.S. analysts, Lloyd Postal Report, concluded that U.S. government's interpretation of the technical intelligence it gathered prior to and after the August 21st attack cannot possibly be correct. Obama authority has been lying. However, now, for the first time, Hearst has implicated Hillary Clinton directly in this rat line. In an interview with Alternet.org, Hearst was asked about the then U.S. Secretary of State's role in the Benghazi, Libya, U.S. consulate's operation to collect weapons from Libyan stockpiles, send them through Turkey into Syria for a set-up sarin gas attack, to be blamed on Assad in order to justify U.S. invading Syria, as the U.S. had invaded Libya to eliminate Gaddafi, Hearst said. That ambassador who was killed, he was known as a guy, from what I understand, as somebody who would not get in the way of the CIA. As I wrote, on the day of the mission, he was meeting with the CIA base chief and the shipping company. He was certainly involved, aware of and witting of everything that was going on, and there's no way somebody in that sensitive of a position is not talking to the boss by some channel. This was, in fact, the Syrian part of the State Department's Libyan operation, Obama operation, to set up an excuse for the U.S. doing in Syria what they had already done in Libya. The interviewer then asked, in the book, Hirsch's The Killing of Osama Bin Laden, just out, you quote a former intelligence official as saying that the White House rejected 35 target sets for the planned U.S. invasion of Syria provided by the Joint Chiefs as being insufficiently painful to the Assad regime. You know, the original targets included military sites only, nothing by way of civilian infrastructure. Later, the White House proposed a target list that included civilian infrastructure. What would the toll to civilians have been if the White House proposed strike had been carried out? Oh yeah, by the way. So we start our war on our terrorists by bombing oil installations in Syria, while the Erdogan son Bilal is buying the oil. Okay, so you couldn't get further from the, you're destroying the infrastructure of the target victims with no pretense. You cannot even, we are so stupid, we buy two drones after a stand down, bringing down three buildings. So Hearst responded by saying that U.S. tradition in that regard has long been to ignore civilian casualties, i.e. collateral damage if U.S. strikes is okay or even desired, so as to terrorize the population into surrender. Not an issue except perhaps with the PR people. The interviewer asked why Obama is so obsessed to replace Assad in Syria, since the power vacuum that would ensue would open Syria up to all kinds of jihadi groups, unquote. And Hearst replied that not only he but the Joint Chiefs of Staff honestly Nobody can figure out why, he said. Our policy has always been against him, Assad, period. This has actually been the case not only since the CIA's first coup had been This had actually been the case not only since the party that Assad heads, the Ba'ath Party, was the subject of a shell CIA coup plot in 57 to overthrow and replace it, but actually the CIA's first coup had been not just planned but carried out in 49 in Syria, overthrowing there a democratically elected leader in order to enable a pipeline for the Saudis. Oil to become built through Syria into the largest oil market, Europe, and the construction of the pipeline started the following year. But there was then a succession of Syrian coups, domestic instead of by foreign powers, 54, 63, 66, and finally 70, concluding in the accession of power of Hafez al-Assad during the 70 coup, and the Saudis' long-planned Trans-Arabian pipeline has still not been built. The Saudi royal family, who owned the world's largest oil company, Aramco, don't want to wait any longer. Obama is the first U.S. president to have seriously tried to carry out through Syria the Qatar-Turkey gas pipeline that the Sani royal family, friends of the Saudis who own Qatar, want also to be built there. The U.S. is allied with the Saudi family and with their friends and the royal families of Qatar, Kuwait, UAE, Bahrain, and Oman. Russia is allied with the leaders of Syria, as Russia had early been allied with Mossadegh in Iran, Arbenz in Guatemala, Allende in Chile, Hussein in Iraq, Gaddafi in Libya, and Yanukovych in Ukraine, all of whom, except Syria's Ba'ath Party, the U.S. had successfully overthrown. Hirsch was wrong to say that nobody could figure out why Obama is obsessed with overthrowing Assad and his Ba'ath Party. Even if nobody that he spoke with was willing to say why, they have all been hired to do a job which didn't change even when the Soviet Union ended, when the Warsaw Pact was disbanded. And anyone who has been at this job for as long as those people have can pretty well figure out what that job actually is, even if Hirsch can't. Thank you, ZeroHedge.com News, 2016-501. Seymour Hirsch says Hillary approved sending Libya Syrian rebels.
Yeah, I am.
Libyan Saren to Syrian rebels.
Yeah.
So, where were we?
Stunning fakery in the alleged chemical weapons attack, according to a former UK ambassador. Coming up.
The British Broadcasting Corporation is accused of staging chemical weapons attack. The CIA admits planting CNN reporters. And international lawyers call for journalists inciting violence to be expelled.
August 2013, and NATO leaders can't get the public on side for the imminent bombing of Syria. Suddenly, the BBC says it was filming a small rural hospital, and a game-changing atrocity happens right there, the moment they were filming.
Last month, we were filming the doctors working at this hospital when victims of an incendiary bomb attack on a school playground started pouring in.
Absolute chaos and carnage here. It must be some sort of napalm.
But a highly sceptical public stayed hostile to military intervention. Exactly 1 month later, the leaders are trying to pin a chemical weapons attack on Syria without success. The BBC airs exactly the same footage but digitally alters the word napalm for, quote, chemical weapons, hoping no one will notice.
Absolute chaos and carnage here. It must be some sort of chemical weapon.
Not only did folks notice, but it unleashed a massive public investigation, which made some extremely disturbing findings.
This is the total fabrication. From beginning to end of an atrocity with BBC reporter Ian Pannell standing amidst a tableau of very bad actors. This is completely beyond the pale.
This audio analysis by media investigator Robin Upton shows both versions are identical and from the same speech. The BBC then digitally altered the words from napalm to chemical weapon, the exact justification NATO was finding difficult to prove. That game-changing allegation was made by two doctors that had travelled with the BBC, who claimed the number of sudden casualties is, quote, overwhelming. What kind of doctor, notes media investigator Robert Stewart, gives interviews when she is surrounded by supposedly seriously burned and dying teenagers?
Get anyone who isn't a patient out of here.
When a nurse does finally start to help, her order to get anyone who isn't a patient out of here doesn't apply to the cameramen. Even worse, notes Stewart, is the bizarre acting which starts when the man in the centre gives the sign.
What do you need to see? We are just human beings. We want to live, you know? Isn't it our right to live?
Dr. Roller, on whose sole claim the BBC sends napalm chemical weapons allegations around the world, is actually the daughter of Syrian rebel Musa al-Qadi. The parallel to the Gulf War and nurse Naira is stunning. Congressman said the nurse's tearful testimony that Iraqis were killing children swung their vote in favor of war.
Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
Nurse Naira became the mainstream's darling, but once the vote had safely passed, she admitted inventing the whole thing and was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to Washington, lying to get the public to back war. UK Member of Parliament George Galloway joins us. Thank you very much for coming on. Why do we get almost identical claims before each war, which then prove lies?
Well, the Bush and Blair Corporation, as it became in the run-up to the Iraq War, has almost entirely lost its reputation for journalistic integrity. A full inquiry must be launched into why the BBC used a piece of material which was not just wrong, but was falsified, and falsified with the purpose of propelling our country into war. That's not what the British public pays its BBC license fee for, so that it can be tricked into a war.
In a statement, the British Broadcasting Corporation says it stands by its report. The Syrian opposition denies the allegations. Investigators such as Robert Stewart note their many questions sent officially to the corporation remain unanswered. There are also numerous such precedents, both in this war and previous invasions. Brilliant is how a top Western official called tricking the public through routine faking of atrocities and commonly aired on mainstream bulletins. Nightly news shows just a few cases of what happened next after mainstream cameras ended their reports.
It shows people putting on, you know, fake wounds. It shows there's some guys there, look, there's their head wounds. Peace, everybody. You know, we're doing the right thing. We're creating fake propaganda. I mean, it's not even real atrocities. So they're there lined up. There was another video. It shows some guy kicking his leg and with a fake blood wound. Here's a guy who wakes up from his funeral. Watch this. They're reading. Oh, there. Oh, wait. There. Oh, he's awake. He's not even really dead. And so, I mean, this is just crazy what goes on. There was another video that was shot of a supposed massacre. And it cuts. You don't see the whole thing. When you go to the Al Jazeera footage, it shows real quick clips of a guy kicking his leg and he's got blood coming out, which turned out to be fake blood.
The so-called activists behind the fakes are by far the most popular source, despite them never being verified and regularly disproved as fabrications to justify more NATO arms. The term activist may sound like a well-meaning Western campaigner or charity, but the Foreign Policy Journal notes it's just newspeak for insurgents. The official source on Syria casualties, or what mainstream claims is official, is impressive-sounding organization the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. Reuters exposed the fact 3 years ago it was not an organization at all, or even working in Syria. It's a single pro-insurgent supporter living in Coventry, England. here pictured at the Foreign Office after instructions from Britain's foreign minister himself. In leaked footage, ordinary Syrians told the BBC they're tired of its lies and the insurgents they're cheerleading are a tiny minority led by foreign gangs.
You don't like BBC?
BBC,
why?
Say it. No, BBC, say it.
Because you are talking very bad about Syria. Everybody, when BBC Arabic, he can hear the lie about Syria. Al Jazeera and Arabic.
But maybe Syria is like any country. Some people support and some people don't.
No, everybody has support.
So Syria is different.
There is very little people. The, maybe 10,000 like that. But the most of people. 22 million, 23 million persons support Bashar al-Assad.
But even the
we have not demonstration. We have armed gangs.
Pro-war media's forced to resort to colossal lies since intelligence chiefs revealed to America's top investigative reporter, Cy Hirsch, quote, Obama's cronies are making it up. All the evidence actually points to the jihadis staging the chemical attacks.
The attack was not the result of the current regime, the high-level intelligence officer wrote in an email to a colleague. The guys are throwing their hands in the air and saying, how can we help this guy, Obama, when he and his cronies in the White House make up the intelligence as they go along, said a former senior intelligence official. The distortion, he said, reminded him of the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
What?
The president wants a white one.
He wants a white one? A white? Let me talk.
He's mobilizing the 6th Fleet.
The thought a U.S. president would start a horrific foreign war by staging a pretty female front as a victim made people laugh.
The young Albanian national fleeing in this video is attempting to escape terrorist reprisals in her village.
Meet Julia, if that's her real name, the celebrated face mass media call the creator of a viral video asking the U.S. to help Ukraine. It was actually created by the State Department's National Endowment for Democracy to mask the fact Washington joined Ukraine's thugs and murdered their way to power. A leaked phone call with EU Foreign Minister Ashton revealed the opposition planned and executed the infamous sniper violence of Kiev, shooting both the police and their own supporters in the back. Study found a total of 250 mainstream sources lied that the snipers belonged to Yanukovych. Only 7 of the entire mass media even mentioned the bombshell leak, and those that did framed the report to suggest it couldn't possibly be true. Former Wall Street Journal editor Paul Craig Roberts calls the coverage of Ukraine a new low in the history of the mainstream, which is now simply what he describes as a ministry of lies. Investigative reporter John Helmers uncovered the mainstream staging demonstrations and attempts to provoke disorder. He joins us. Great to speak to you. One US scholar notes the coverage has now become Orwellian. What's going on?
So the weaker your government, the more interested the leader might be in threatening Russia to look strong at home when it's obvious he's not strong at home and couldn't get re-elected. That's particularly true, let's say, of the French president or the Prime Minister Cameron at the moment. And arguably, President Obama is not only a lame duck, but having great difficulty in putting together a winning coalition for the Democratic Party's next candidate for president. When you've got weak political leaders, you need to look stronger than you are in public opinion in the media. So there's this process of misleading and disinforming.
The Senate committee inquiry revealed CIA running mainstream media in the vast operation known as Mockingbird. More than 400 journalists and media chiefs claiming to watchdog the government were the exact opposite, joining to mask US government crime at home and abroad. The operation continues despite agency denials. Counterpunch discovered CIA imposing agents on firms like CNN. Former CIA exec Michael Sher notes British media are even closer to intel targets.
Big pieces of wood, metal, to use as barricades.
Sher adds the BBC now takes the lead in regime change operations that cause, quote, anarchy and violence. Let's speak to Francis Boyle, Professor of International Law at Illinois University. Great to talk to you. How can nations stop war media that now perform the CIA's covert operations?
Certainly have their visas revoked and sent
packing home, because I really don't understand why some of these countries keep, European journalists, certainly in the United States, why they let them into the countries, because they're just using their coverage to promote war and military intervention at home. In addition, Bush Jr. administration lifted what was supposed to be the previous prohibition that intelligence agents were not supposed to infiltrate the media. You know, you have to be very careful, certainly dealing with U.S. Reporters, whether or not they're intelligence agents.
Banning active units of the military, also known as war stream media, shows how serious the situation now is. Their policies aren't popular with their own viewers. Mainstream audiences are in free fall. CNN and MSNBC have shed half their entire viewership in the last year alone. The question is, how many more coups will they stage or help before they lose the public's trust altogether? Seek truth from facts. This is The Truth Seeker.
Now we'll go to Max Blumenthal pulling the covers on the white helmets and their child beheading friends. Of course, Mahmoud Erdogan is the photographer who filmed a dust covered child and also who did a selfie with a Zenki militia, Mark Toner's friends. Your friends, getting all that, at least you give them money to cut the heads off of children.
Welcome to The Real News. I'm Tharna Noor, joining you from Baltimore. A group of rescue workers known as the White Helmets is receiving wide acclaim for its work in Syria. They've won a 2016 Right Livelihood Award, which is widely known as the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize. They're also the subject of a new Netflix documentary. And most media outlets portray the White Helmets as a humanitarian organization made up of ordinary Syrians who have no political agenda but that of peace in Syria. But a new investigation published by the Gray Zone Project at Alternet has found that the White Helmets, as well as an associated public relations firm, the Syria Campaign, are far from impartial. In fact, they're seeking regime change in Syria. Joining us to discuss this investigation is Max Blumenthal. Max is a senior editor of the Gray Zone Project at Alternet. His most recent book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Thanks for joining us, Max.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Max, the White Helmets are being represented by lots of media, again, as nonpartisan and neutral. They're depicted as just a group that wants peace and nothing else. But you argue, based on your investigation, that they're not neutral at all, and you found that they're specifically linked to a regime change agenda. So tell us what you found and how you found it.
Well, I think that, you know, the White Helmets, like first responders anywhere, including in West Aleppo and in the government areas of Syria and in Yemen, in Palestine, anywhere in the world, deserve a lot of praise for rescuing people in an impossible situation. But this is a particularly unusual first responder organization that's also going to Washington, was just in Washington this week at the Atlantic Council, alongside former Defense Department and State Department official Frederick Hoff, to push for some kind of missile strikes on Syria from the U.S. This was a shocking event, and it's of a part with the overall agenda of this organization. The White Helmets were created in 2013 with funding from Western governments and training from a British mercenary named James Le Mercier, who was operating formerly as a mercenary protecting gas fields in the UAE. He moves into southern Turkey with money from the State Department and the British Foreign Office to train up a group of first responders. The money that this group started to receive, first in the hundreds of thousands and then in the millions, came through the USAID, the United States Aid and International Development Agency for International Development's Office of Transitional Initiatives. This is, as Jake Johnson at the Center for Economic Policy and Research has demonstrated, the political arm of USAID, the arm that has promoted regime change and political subversion around the globe. And the point funding the White Helmets was not necessarily humanitarian. The 23 million, at least 23 million that this group has received, was, according to the State Department official overseeing some of the grants, Mark Ward, aimed at shoring up the civil and governing entities in what he called liberated territory, which is actually rebel-held territory. So basically, to promote a civil and government structure in areas that had been taken from the Syrian government in order to make way and prepare for the eventual removal of the Syrian government and replacement with some kind of government like we've seen in Iraq and Libya, which didn't exactly work out very well. Now, the White Helmets make no secret about their desire to ratchet up military intervention in Syria. They're calling for a no-fly zone, which sounds pretty good if you're a complete dupe and you don't actually interrogate the meaning of a no-fly zone, which even Hillary Clinton is now pulling away from. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dumford, recently testified at the Senate Arms Committee that imposing a no-fly zone over Syria would, in his words, require us to go to war against Syria and Russia. That's a pretty fundamental decision that I'm not going to make. In other words, it would require World War III. According to a 2012 Pentagon assessment, a no-fly zone in Syria would require 70,000 U.S. troops to implement. The wide-scale attacks on Syrian military and government installations, this would, of course, mean more civilian casualties. And we've never seen a no-fly zone imposed anywhere, whether it's Iraq, Libya, or the former Yugoslavia, where it didn't lead to regime change. So if you're calling for a no-fly zone, you're calling for regime change, and you have to be able to tell me what's going to come the day after this government collapses. And it hasn't been a very good scenario before, so I think there needs to be a serious debate about the consequences of regime change. The public relations firm, which is handling the White Helmets and is entirely responsible for the general public knowing about the White Helmets, for the sensation around them.
Here you're talking about the PR firm, the Syria Campaign.
Yes. So the Syria Campaign is an opposition-funded public relations firm. It's a private company registered along with 91 other companies. Doesn't really have an office. It was actually created by a public relations firm called Purpose, which itself was spun out of Avaaz. Avaaz being the international kind of online clicktivist organization that promoted a no-fly zone in Syria. And the Syria Campaign is devoted to rallying public opinion for a no-fly zone in Syria, which means regime change. And I don't think that's a very good scenario, but, you know, again, that should be debated. What I did with these two stories was, I think, demonstrate that the White Helmets are one of the major public relations instruments in a lobbying push to rally public opinion, cultivate Western opinion in support of a no-fly zone or some kind of increased Western military intervention, which would topple the Syrian government.
So how did the Syria Campaign build its public image as a neutral organization to protect Syrians, if you're saying, in fact, it's not neutral at all, it's strongly in support of regime change?
Well, if you think that a no-fly zone will protect Syrians, then, you know, you should cop to that, and you should cop to your support for regime change. But this group is, you know, it understands how to use language, particularly liberal-friendly, humanitarian-sounding language, and banal appeals to solidarity as cover for pushing for heightened military intervention. The Syria Campaign, as I said, was spun out of a public relations firm called Purpose, which is based in New York City and London. It's represented clients like the ACLU and Campaign Zero, gay rights organizations, and it claims credit for affecting perception change. But in this case, when it started its Voices project and began hiring people around the West who were public relations professionals to do storytelling and public mobilization, that's when the Syria Campaign began pushing for regime change, when Purpose began pushing for regime change. This was when the Syria Campaign was born. This organization is funded by Ayman Asfari, who is the chairman and CEO of Petrofac. It's a petroleum services company. Asfari is a Syrian-British expatriate billionaire who is determined to see the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian government and its replacement with a government chosen by his Syrian National Council. Now, I should mention that the majority of Syrians, according to a 2015 poll, find that the Syrian opposition coalition, and by the way, this is a poll by Opinion Research, July 20th coalition, is more harmful to Syria than the current Syrian government. It's almost as unpopular as ISIS among Syrians who've been polled across Syria. But this is the agenda that Asfari is seeking to impose from the outside. This is a close ally and funder of the Tory, the Conservative Party in the UK, a close ally of former Prime Minister David Cameron, and he has funded the Syria campaign with $180,000 this year out of a $100,000 budget. He's also a major supporter of the White Helmets, whose website and entire public presence has been built by the Syria campaign. And that's what this is about. So it's not just about the noble cause of rescuing people from rubble under Syrian and Russian bombing in East Aleppo. It's about defining, first of all, everything that happens in East Aleppo as something that's happening in all of Syria, ignoring the whole picture of what's happening across Syria. It's about working media contacts to promote and cultivate the public with an interventionist narrative. And the Syria campaign has been very effective at that, as I've demonstrated. And it's about ultimately moving public opinion towards eventual regime change.
And can you talk a bit more about how the Syria campaign has done that, specifically how they've affected reporting on the Syrian conflict itself?
Well, I mean, one incident was really telling, and this was the incident of the famous Omran photo. I mean, this photo is really touching. It shows a 5-year-old boy, Omran Dakhnish, who's been taken out of a building that had been bombed probably by Syrian warplanes in eastern Aleppo, or perhaps Russian airplanes, and he's positioned inside an ambulance with his face caked in ash and blood, to be photographed and videotaped. That video and those photographs were immediately relayed to Western media. One of the organizations that captured the video first was the Aleppo Media Center, which is also run from outside Syria by the Syrian Expatriates Network. That video was first reproduced. One of the first reporters to reproduce it was Sophie McNeil of the Australian Broadcast Corporation, and the image of Omran went viral. Next, we saw the Syria campaign furnish quotes by the videographer and photographer who took that video, Mahmoud Raslan, who is from the Aleppo Media Center.
The neocon warhawks have embroiled the United States in illegal wars of aggression around the globe, and with the possibility of a Clinton presidency, that reign of terror looks set to continue. But a series of lawsuits are challenging the neocons in the courts and threatening to derail that agenda. This is the GRTV Backgrounder on Global Research TV. On June 28, 2016, the Miami-based law firm Beck and Lee served then-Democratic National Committee Chair Debbie Wasserman and the DNC itself with a class-action lawsuit for rigging the 2016 Democratic primary race in favor of Hillary Clinton. The lawsuit, filed in the Southern District of Florida, alleges that the DNC broke its own legally binding neutrality agreements by plotting to make Hillary Clinton the Democratic Party's presidential nominee even before the primaries had begun. It points to evidence from leaked DNC emails that expose how DNC officials treated Clinton as the only Democratic candidate, even after Bernie Sanders officially declared his candidacy in April 2015. But the lawsuit did not gain international notoriety until August 2nd, when Sean Lucas, the process server who served the suit to the DNC, was found dead in his home.
Sean, hi, Becca.
How are you doing, Becca?
I'm just with the DNC upstairs.
With the DNC?
Yes.
All right. Well, this is going to be a service to the DNC.
Okay.
And this is for Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Perfect.
You guys have been served.
Okay.
Thank you so much. We'll see you in court. Guys, thank you so much for everything. Have a great day.
Thank you.
And happy 4th of July.
Thank you.
All right. All right. We were able to deliver the documents.
Yeah, they wouldn't give us any of the head honchos, which I kind of had a feeling wasn't going to happen. But we did make contact with somebody from the Democratic National Committee's office, and they've been served. Democracy has prevailed today.
But in a bizarre twist of events, on August 2nd, less than 1 month after serving the subpoena, Lucas was reported dead. According to police records, Lucas's girlfriend found him lying on the floor unresponsive when she returned home that evening and immediately called 911. Paramedics said there was no sign of life by the time they arrived on the scene. Police are not releasing the cause of death at this time and are not commenting on speculation that Lucas was murdered.
Although Lucas's unusual and still unexplained death has dominated media coverage of the story, missing from this narrative is that the death of this process server has not changed, derailed, or stopped the case from proceeding. Jared Beck, the managing partner of the law firm that brought the suit, stopped to discuss the case after an evidentiary hearing late last month.
We got involved because we got hired by hundreds and hundreds and now even thousands of people that after the primary happened and after all of these documents came out that we have from WikiLeaks and other sources, they came to us and said, you know, this process, we don't believe this was a fair process and we want to bring claims as...
The neocon warhawks have embroiled the United States in illegal wars of aggression around the globe. Seven Council of Europe report, a 2008 U.S. Armed Services Committee report, the testimony of U.N. Special Rapporteurs Nowak and Scheinen, a 2009 admission by Cheney, and Bush's own 2010 memoirs. But in this case, Canadian authorities refused to enforce the law by bringing charges against him.
For any damage that she sustained, just like anyone would in a personal injury case, was to impose...
speak at a fundraiser for the United Israel Appeal after it was revealed that a number of human rights groups were planning to prosecute him for war crimes, including contravention of the Convention Against Torture, to which the United States is a signatory. Another round of lobbying preceded Bush's appearance at a speaking engagement in Surrey, BC later that year, citing the evidence in a 2006 UN report, a 2007 Council of Europe report, a 2008 U.S. Armed Services Committee report, the testimony of UN Special Rapporteurs Nowak and Scheinen, a 2009 admission by Cheney, and Bush's own 2010 memoirs. But in this case, Canadian authorities refused to enforce the law by bringing charges against him. Perhaps most notably, Bush and seven key members of his administration, including Cheney, Rumsfeld, and their legal advisors, were tried and convicted in absentia by the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission for the war crimes of torture and cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. Although the commission has no method of enforcing the decision, the conviction still stands and could potentially be used by a prosecutor if and when Bush or his colleagues step foot in a jurisdiction that is willing to uphold the law. Whether it be the class action lawsuit against the DNC, Saleh v. Bush, or the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission conviction, there remains brave lawyers and prosecutors that are willing to stand up to the neocons, even if such a stand puts them in harm's way. If the public is truly interested in justice for the war crimes and aggression of this dangerous faction, it is incumbent on them to stand with those who are attempting to prosecute them. Now available from globalresearch.ca, The Threat of Nuclear War, The Destabilization of Foreign Countries, The Movement to Resist This Worldwide Aggression. These are the topics addressed in The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity, the new book by award-winning author Professor Michelle Jasadowski.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle.
the spiral downward continues with no end in sight. The dangerous escalation of tensions separating Russia and the West witness a decline in diplomatic engagement, particularly concerning Syria. What can we expect next? To Crosstalk Declining Russia-U.S. Relations, I'm joined by my guest, Ray McGovern in Washington. He's a former CIA analyst and co-founder of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Also in Washington, we have Earl Rasmussen. He is the executive vice president of the Eurasia Center. And in Providence, we cross to Vladimir Goldstein. He is an associate professor of Slavic Studies at Brown University. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I very much appreciate it. Ray, if I can go to you first, my question will be obvious, but maybe the answer won't be. We all know that there is a hail of tightened rhetoric coming out of Washington, exclusively directed at Russia, primarily dealing with Syria, but other issues, other lingering issues over the past 2 years. What does Washington want from Russia with this kind of undiplomatic rhetoric? Go ahead.
Well, the elephant in the room happens to be a country called Israel. U.S. policy towards Syria cannot be explained without realizing that Syria poses no danger at all to the United States, but is perceived by Israel as posing a danger to Israel because through Syria comes the resupply for Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And so the Israelis have made it abundantly clear that would like to cut off that supply chain, and what better way to do it than to create chaos in Syria? It's in their documents, it's in Hillary Clinton's documents. Now, this is not a leak. This is not a hack. This is State Department released documents where Hillary Clinton said it will be a massive boon to Israeli security if we can remove Bashar al-Assad. She said that in April 2012. This is the elephant in the room. As long as Obama and his policymakers favor the objectives and interests of Israel, there's no way out of this quagmire.
Okay, Earl, but you know that's truly scary because Syria is no security threat to the United States. It's not a security threat to any country right now after 5 years of civil war here. I mean, the Americans walk away from diplomacy. Did they even take it seriously in the first place? Because I would think members of the panel and our viewers were hoodwinked into believing that John Kerry was some kind of dove. Well, certainly he's not. Go ahead, Earl.
Well, he just spoke recently that he's one of the few people within the administration that advocated for more aggressive military force and presence there. But that said, I think we've lost picture, and it's interesting what Ray said too is, and it's true. There is concern about Syria's partnership with Hezbollah, but I think we've lost the whole picture of where.
Newsmakers are saying Biden is in a panic.
So maybe in an immediate goal.
Well, it depends on your point of view.
Okay.
For Israel, it's just been hunky dory, you know?
Sure.
Syria is a shambles.
Sure.
And so, now, if we want to look at U.S. Russian policy, that's different. And that's far more important for us and for the Russians. This, too, has been really, really up and down. 3 years ago, Putin pulled Obama's chestnuts out of the fire by getting Bashar al-Assad to give up his chemical weapons for destruction on a U.S. naval ship. That was 3 years ago. 1 year ago, Putin and Obama got together at the end of the U.N. session in September of last year, 2015, and Putin said, look, you know, it's not going well in Syria. We're not really impressed by your offensive against the jihadists. As you know, we've brought aircraft and other weaponry into Syria. We're going to start using that tomorrow. We just want to let you know we're going to take the bull by the horns, and we hope that you will cooperate.